From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. Welcome, Linda and Steve.
Hi, Kim.
Glad to be here, Kim.
Here are the issues. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Russia was ready to facilitate Ukrainian grain shipments from ports along the Black Sea, but that he wants Western countries to lift their sanctions against Russian grain exports. Putin spoke in Iran after meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Ukrainian First Lady Olena Zelenska spoke to U.S. lawmakers on Capitol Hill in person as her country continues its defense against Russia's invasion. She asked Congress for more weapons to help end the conflict. President Joe Biden announced new executive steps to combat climate change, a move that comes as Democrats urge the administration to issue a climate emergency declaration amid stalled negotiations over major environmental legislation and as temperatures soar across the U.S. and Europe. An attorney representing Stephen Bannon, the former Trump advisor charged with unlawfully defying a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack, suggested to a jury that political motivations are driving the case against his client. The trial began this week amid a series of House of Representatives Select Committee hearings that have painted former President Trump and his allies as the orchestrators of various schemes to undermine the 2020 election. Police said a suspect in an Indiana mall shooting on July 17th fired 24 times within 15 seconds before he was stopped by an armed bystander. The shooter had already killed three people and injured two. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Russian President Vladimir Putin met with Turkish and Iranian leaders in Tehran on Tuesday, only his second foreign trip since he launched the invasion of Ukraine in February. Linda, what do you make of this trip?
It was one of the most interesting developments of the week. This trilateral meeting would seem to suggest some kind of a new anti-American alliance, but it's much more complicated than that. So Turkey is, of course, a member of NATO and has in some ways been helpful to the NATO alliance against Ukraine, but in other ways it hasn't. Russia, of course, is not in any way doing anything to help us. And frankly, their offer to facilitate Ukrainian grain shipments from ports along the Black Sea is disingenuous. He says he'll do that if he gets, you know, Western sanctions against Russian grain exports lifted. Well, that's not happening. And then you have Iran, where, of course, we're in negotiations to resume the deal to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, a negotiation that, of course, Russia is a party to. So you have this very sort of tangled situation of people working their own interests. It's all very transactional, and the U.S. is trying to get the most out of it, but it's really hard, and I'm not sure that we're going to see any resolution to any of these issues anytime soon.
One of the issues as far as the grain shipments out of Ukraine is that much of the problems and the shortages of food that are going to appear, especially in Africa and other parts of Asia, goes directly to these are countries that Russia needs as far as support for not just its actions in Ukraine, but for much of its actions around the world. So in preventing those grain shipments from coming out of Ukraine, Russia may be hurting its own long-term and distant relationships with these countries. Iran, as Linda pointed out, is not necessarily trying, but is in negotiations regarding the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And that has the United States working its own allies and its own opportunities to get Iran back into the deal. So you've got quite a few world problems that are bouncing up against each other. And the visit by President Putin to Tehran not just was symbolic as far as who was there, but it was the first time Putin went out of the country since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So, as Linda said, a lot going on there and not quite sure where it will wind up as far as getting grain out or moving this situation toward an end.
Yes, and then we also have Ukrainian First Lady Olena Zelenska, who spoke to U.S. lawmakers on Capitol Hill, detailing atrocities occurring against women and girls by Russian forces in Ukraine. So how significant was her visit to Washington?
I'd say it was quite significant. It's very unusual to have the first spouse of a world leader address Congress. The idea, of course, was to boost interest among Americans in the war in Ukraine. We're having war fatigue right now at this point. The invasion took place, 4 months ago? And American interest has dropped dramatically. And the Ukrainians are fighting for their lives as ever. Mrs. Zelenska, she's attractive. She's articulate. She's, of course, the wife of Volodymyr Zelensky, who's also a highly sympathetic figure. So this was, you know, just another way to keep the pressure on so that Americans not only will feel sympathy for Ukraine, but want to spend more money on weapons. She pleaded for more weapons, which is the top message of her husband as well. Volodymyr Zelensky has said he wants to bring the war to an end by December. But to do that, he needs a lot more military assistance. We have sent some high-level weaponry, but they need more, he says.
As Linda pointed out, really to keep the drumbeat going as far as support for Ukraine here in the United States as well as in Europe, I found that it was very interesting how the Ukrainian First Lady, her use of the Hunger Games as a comparison to the situation in Ukraine, I thought was quite interesting in trying to reach a social media zeitgeist out there and try and attract and hold the attention of especially younger Americans. I felt that the whole appearance on Capitol Hill with various different images in the background, I thought was quite a production, so to speak, in order to not just reach the members of Congress who were there in attendance, but also to be able to take that appearance and be able to slice it up for social media consumption, I thought was a rather brilliant kind of strategy. And I think we're going to see much more of that as we move forward, because as Linda said, if Zelensky wants to try and wind this down by December, there is a lot that needs to be done. I've heard that another package of aid is being prepared as far as military aid to Ukraine. The United States and European allies have donated quite a bit, given Ukraine quite a bit of this. It has been able to allow Ukraine to hit Russian targets a lot deeper, a lot closer to their staging areas by the border. So more of this is necessary for Ukraine to win. And again, there's as well a linkage between looking toward the winter as a way to wrap this up, as well as the climate issue and the need, especially in Europe, for Russia's natural gas. And that's going to be yet another issue to try and wrap this thing up before a hard winter comes.
Those are some really good points that you both have brought out, considering that the U.S. and Europe, allies of Zelensky, they are being pulled away by many domestic crises, as you mentioned, including worsening inflation, exorbitant energy prices, and fears of a global recession. So there's a lot going on there, and we'll just have to see how focused the U.S. and its allies can remain on the war that's going on in Ukraine. Also, President Biden announced new executive steps to combat climate change as his party is eager to see him take steps to reduce carbon emissions as temperatures continue to climb in the U.S. and Britain. So what is the president's goal in taking these executive steps?
The goal is to try and move the United States to a much more carbon neutral kind of way of doing business, but that is such a long way off. The heat waves here and in Europe are coming at a time where energy prices are high, mostly because of Russia's war in Ukraine. And the key Democrat President Biden needed to get on board so that laws can be passed to reduce carbon emissions. He comes from a state whose number one natural resource and business is coal. Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia has been historically protective of the state's coal industry. So that leaves the president with very few options. He can direct the federal government to spend what discretionary dollars he can manage toward various different climate projects. We saw him in the state of Massachusetts touting the wind power energy and moving a coal-fired plant to something that helps the wind power industry. Even declaring a climate emergency would limit the president in what he could do as far as changing the formula, so to speak, of America's energy. So short of being able to pass legislation through Congress, the president does have some options, but they're rather limited.
Does it look like then that climate legislation may be off the table for this summer?
I would say it's likely off the table. Joe Manchin, the senator whom Steve referred to, has said that we're overstating the fact that the climate piece of this larger legislation is done. He's sort of suggesting he's still willing to do something, but we've seen this movie before where he keeps the ball rolling in an ever so slightly and maybe keeps hopes alive that something can be done in this larger legislative package regarding climate change. But I think if I'm Joe Biden, I'm looking at what I can do by executive action. And it's frankly quite limited, especially in light of the recent Supreme Court ruling regarding the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, which said that agencies, federal agencies, have to follow the law in a very explicit way, that they can't read meaning into laws that isn't explicitly there. So right at a time when Joe Biden really needs his executive power, it seems to be shrinking.
And it comes at a time when the extreme heat and high energy prices, high prices for gasoline and oil, is playing on the public. The public wants cheaper gas. The price is going down here in the United States, but it is still rather high compared to even before the pandemic. So it's a double-edged sword. We need more supply to bring the price down, yet producing and burning more oil and gas only increases the climate damage. So trying to mollify the political issue of the high prices at the end may do more damage to the climate. It's a very difficult situation the president faces, as well as leaders from other countries.
And also you have to really look at what is the public's main number one concern at this time. What do you see as the public's number one concern? Is it climate?
It's not. It's inflation. And of course, our spiking gasoline prices feed right into that. But if you look at all the issues on the table, which are considerable, inflation is by far the number one. The overarching issue is the economy. And people are seeing it every day in the higher prices that they're paying for food, for gas, for services, for everything. And then some people think this idea of calling a climate emergency is overstating what's happening. So, yes, it's hot out. Some people will argue, well, it gets hot every summer. And OK, maybe it's a little hotter than usual, but it's not exactly a quote unquote emergency. So you've got, I think, potentially effective counter argument right as we're heading into midterm elections.
Yes, very good point. Well, it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, an attorney representing a former Trump advisor says the case against his client is politically motivated. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voaafrica.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. While defense attorney Evan Corcoran asked jurors to keep the political considerations surrounding the case against his client, Stephen Bannon, former advisor to former President Trump, in mind as evidence is presented to them. So how significant is this case against Stephen Bannon?
You know, it's significant. Steve Bannon was a close advisor to Donald Trump in the run-up to the January 6th riot at the Capitol. It's being portrayed by Republicans as part of the witch hunt, part of the larger effort to discredit Donald Trump and his allies, in particular because Donald Trump may well run for president again. So this isn't just about the past, it's about the future. What was interesting to me about this trial was that the arguments were so short. It ended after a day. I mean, they haven't reached a verdict yet as we speak, but The prosecution only called two witnesses, a congressional staffer and an FBI agent. Basically said he was issued a subpoena to provide testimony and documents, and he failed to do that. Period, end of story. That is against the law. So Steve Bannon, of course, is this larger-than-life character. He usually looks rather disheveled. He cut his hair and looked halfway presentable for the trial. Where this goes, I would guess that he'll be found guilty. But I think in the grand scheme of things, again, this is one of those issues that it doesn't affect the price of gas or the price of food at the grocery store. So I think most Americans don't really care.
By presenting just two witnesses, the government in its prosecution indicated how simple this case is, that Bannon got a subpoena from Congress, he ignored it, and that's a crime, no matter how rare it is both charged or prosecuted. Now, Bannon's attorneys are going to try to bring politics into the trial and show that this has been politically motivated. They tried to do that in cross-examining these two government witnesses. How this works out, it will not necessarily determine or change the course of the investigation that Congress is conducting at the moment about the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Bannon would provide likely some information as to communications, who he was talking to, who others were talking to as well. But for the most part, it is basically a trial to say you were served a subpoena, you ignored it. Now the consequences are going to be discovered. And the judge in the case has made it clear that even though he is a Trump-appointed judge, he has said he intends to keep the politics out of this trial. How well that happens is to be seen, as Bannon's defense now is able to present its case before the jury. We'll see how that plays out over the next several days.
The Atlanta area prosecutors scrutinizing Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia said that all 16 of the, quote, fake electors, unquote, who participated in a plan to subvert the Electoral College are now targets of an ongoing criminal investigation. So how significant is this new development?
It's fairly significant. It shows that this case, which started as an investigation about a phone call made by former President Trump that was recorded to the Secretary of State of Georgia, who is in charge of overseeing the elections in that state. And the phone call pressured the Secretary of State. President Trump pressured him into finding enough votes to win the state. Now, this probe has widened to include 16 people, 16 Republicans, who took part in a scheme to certify the false electors. And this special grand jury is also seeking testimony from a sitting U.S. Senator, Senator Lindsey Graham, who also called the Secretary of State of Georgia. Also, several of the president's closest advisors, including Rudy Giuliani, who a court has told he must testify, he must appear before this grand jury. How this all works out will say a lot as far as whether or not President Trump himself will be prosecuted in Georgia for trying to pressure the Secretary of State to change the vote count.
Very interesting. And on a programming note, the January 6th committee is wrapping up its first round of public hearings this week with a minute-by-minute examination of former President Donald Trump's actions during the attack on the U.S. Capitol. For an in-depth look at the latest public hearings, be sure to tune in to our sister current affairs show, Encounter, with host Carol Castiel, also this weekend. Well, in our last topic, the latest attack in a string of recent mass shootings in the U.S., where a 20-year-old man who shot five people in a suburban Indianapolis shopping mall, killing three of them, fired 24 times within 15 seconds before he was shot and killed by an armed bystander. So just wanted to get each of your comments on this latest shooting and the fact that another individual killed the suspect before he could kill anyone else. Linda.
Yes. Another tragic mass shooting in this country. I mean, it's just so regular. It's just heartbreaking how often this happens here. But of course, what's interesting about this case is that a bystander was armed and immediately within, as I think, as you said, within 15 seconds of the shooter starting to fire at people, the armed bystander took him out. The armed bystander, a young man himself, was carrying a weapon and pulled it out and shot the guy dead. This could have been a much, much bigger tragedy had that bystander not killed the shooter. This, of course, feeds the pro-gun argument that a good guy with a gun is needed to take out the bad guy with a gun. This is the argument you get from the National Rifle Association and other pro-gun people. It's a lobby that's very strong in this country. As we're sorting through the future of the right to bear arms in this country and how that can be regulated, this case, I think, will stand as a very, very large example of why it's not automatically terrible that people are carrying weapons as they're going about their daily business. Of course, people who carry weapons need to be sane and honest and not intending to do harm. So I think the debate only grows over this incident.
And similarly, in Uvalde, Texas, back in May, there was supposed to be a good guy with a gun to stop the bad guy with a gun. And 400 law enforcement good guys with guns who came and responded to the shooting didn't do much of anything to stop the carnage that left 19 students dead and two teachers killed. It was an appalling case of inaction by the police. It did help prompt some movement by Congress to pass some incremental legislation, yet it actually happened. Legislation was passed. I think it does say something about America and its love of guns to say that a school shooting that left 21 people dead was something that helped prompt an incremental move in legislation, however incremental that is.
Yes, that's a really good point. Thank you. Linda, did you want to add more?
All I want to say is that whenever the footage of reaction to the Uvalde shooting, the police standing outside the room and the armed officer being turned away, whose wife was in the classroom who had been shot, I changed the channel. I just can't watch it.
Well, before we close the show, I want to get your personal thoughts on what is weighing on your mind this week. And Steve, we'll start with you.
What's weighing on my mind this week is the heat. I recently took a holiday tour of Norway's fjords and got to experience both the long days and short nights the Scandinavian summers allow and the incredible natural beauty of Norway. Went to the top of a mountain and there was snowpack there. There was about a foot of snowpack at the top of Stranda Mountain, and it was a thrill for me to be able to create a snowball and throw it down the mountain in the middle of July. And it also made me wonder whether my children will be able to do that 20 years from now, whether there will be enough snowpack at the top of the mountains in Scandinavia and places further north for us to make that snowball. It just makes us realize that we've all been raised on sugar that is cheap oil, and at some point we're going to have to go on an energy diet and find a sugar substitute in order to move not just the United States, but the world forward.
Very good. Thank you. And Linda?
I love the idea of going hiking in Norway. We actually just went hiking in Vermont, which has a similarly cool and beautiful summer climate. But I've been thinking about actually another story from Indiana about the 25-year-old pizza delivery man who was driving down the street and saw a house engulfed in flames and stopped his car, got out, went into the house and saved five people. He had gotten four out, and then they said the baby is inside. Well, the baby was a six-year-old. He went back in, found the six-year-old, and had to jump out of a second-story window to save her life. He came out of it quite injured. He had broken, I think he had like a severed tendon, severe burns, soot in his lungs, but he's going to be fine. And here's another thing that I love. His cousin set up a crowdfunding page to raise money for his medical care. His goal was $100,000, and so far it's raised over $500,000. So I think even amid all of our challenges, there's a lot of good out there that people caring about others selflessly and a great sense of humanity in these challenging times.
Those are some really good thoughts to end the show on, hiking and saving lives. What better way can you end a show? And my thanks go to our panelists, Christian Science Monitor Washington Bureau Chief Linda Feldman and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to visit us at voaafrica.com for all of our VOA current affairs shows and other news programs. Thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.